سيدنا محمد وعليه الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وعلى 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 اللهم كل وليك الحجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى روائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وغائلا وناصرا ودليلا وعينا وحتى تسكنه أرضك توعى وتمتعه فيها طويلا. السلام عليك أيتها الصديقة الشهيدة. We begin by expressing our condolences to the holy imam of our time and the Ahlul Bayt and all of the mu'mineen, mu'minat, the lovers and followers of the Ahlul Bayt on the martyrdom anniversary of the mother of the Ummah, the mother of all of the believers and the mother of all of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, the first Fatimiyya, Lady Fatima sallallahu alayha. May we be of her true followers and of her true children, to be trained, inshallah, under her training and to learn from her teachings. What I've shared tonight, inshallah, is just a few reminders, really, practical reminders from the life of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayha, specifically revolving around the concept of family. Now, there's a lot to be said, of course, and someone much more qualified than myself can speak to the existential and metaphysical merits of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayha. Our tradition is rich in that dimension, and I'm sure we've heard in Majalis as well of the great stature of Lady Fatima. So my intention in not mentioning many of those is not, God forbid, to belittle or to ignore that, but rather because I'm not well versed and I don't understand those teachings very well. What I'll do is, inshallah, I'll share those practical reminders. And these are the things that we hope to take away, and I think understanding the position and the merit that Lady Fatima sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has, especially for us, we can receive these teachings and we can receive these reminders, hopefully, in a fashion that does justice to what their lives were, a life of teaching. And although Lady Fatima sallallahu alayhi wa sallam lived a very short life in comparison to the people of her age, her life was rich with teachings and practical examples of what it means to live as a good Muslim, as a good mother, as a good wife, as a good daughter, a child, and a good member of her community. So my intention here is to just share those things. So I know we're all in different places in our lives, and we may receive these differently, but I think in everything that's being shared tonight, there's a moral, there's a lesson for all of us, regardless of where we are, for a father, for a mother, for a daughter, for a son. We can, inshallah, receive these well. So I want to begin to preface the talk on the importance of family. I'm not going to really get into the crisis of the family and the nuclear family. I think we can sense whether we live in times of crisis or whether we live in times of difficulty, whether our beliefs or our morals, or our views, or ideologies are being attacked or not. We can bracket that for the time being. But simply the fact of living a noble life, a virtuous life, this is not an easy task. So we are tested in this life to try and live nobly. And Allah will present different challenges for us to the extent of our capacities. And how we respond to that, how we react to that, determines how God will reward us, but also it also reflects the level of development and growth that we are experiencing. And this is perhaps the most important thing to keep in mind. So in Surah At-Tahrim, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala instructs the believing community to protect themselves and to protect their families from the result and the outcome of a life that's lived without concentration, without being conscious and cognizant of the outcome of our actions. So in verse number 6, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. Protect yourselves, O you who believe, and your families as well from the punishment of the fire. عليها ملائكة غلاظ شداد لا يعصون الله ما أمرهم ويفعلون ما يؤمرون. Of course, this punishment, this fire, this outcome is protected and assigned by a number of angels that are severe and mighty and who do not disobey the commands of God, and they do whatever they've been commanded to do. So the first instruction here to remember is that it's addressing the believing community. So there are a number of presuppositions, there are a number of ideals and beliefs that we all agree on. So we don't really need to go over those fundamental and foundational beliefs that we have as far as what the family stands for, what the pillars of the family are, what constitutes a good family life. I'm not going to go over these. And I'm just going to take within the context of the verse that's being presented. This is being presented to a believing community. So this is being taken for granted that we know at least what the essentials are, what it means to live in a righteous family. Regardless of whether we're living in the West, in the East, that doesn't matter. That's number one. The second verse that I want to share is from Surah Al-Ra'd that speaks about the family as a unit that's supposed to remain united and together, both in this world and the hereafter. So the journey that the family is embarking on is not one that's going to end with death, but it's one that's supposed to continue afterwards. And a lot of the ra'ayat and the verses of the Quran that speak about the scenes of judgment and entering into the final abode of whether it's heaven or hell, they consider the family to be a single unit. And they try as best to keep and to protect the sanctity of what that unity is. And once that is broken, different elements and different people within the family unit will also ask, you know, where's the rest of my family? It's understood that they're supposed to be kept together. In Surah Al-Ra'd states, جَنَّاتُ عَدْنٍ يَدْخُلُونَهَا. They are gardens of Eden that they shall enter themselves. وَمَنْ صَلَحَ مِنْ آبَائِهِمْ وَأَزْوَاجِهِمْ وَذُرِّيَّاتِهِمْ. The person themselves will enter, but also from their fathers, from their forebears, from their spouses, and from their descendants, those who were righteous will also accompany them into their final abode, which in this case are the gardens of Eden. وَالْمَلَائِكَةُ يَدْخُلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ مِنْ كُلِّ بَابٍ. And the angels will call unto them from every door, سَلَامٌ عَلَيْكُمْ بِمَا صَبَرْتُمْ فَنِعْمَ عُقْبَى الدَّارِ. Peace be unto you for your patience, and excellent is the reward of this ultimate abode. So look, it's already considering that the unit that is supposed to remain together has been patient throughout life, because to enter into paradise alone is already difficult enough. But to ensure that the family unit is also kept intact and them collectively to enter into paradise is a much more difficult task. So what really we've been encouraged and obliged to do in establishing righteous families is to ensure not only that we protect and save ourselves, to live righteous lives for ourselves, but we take on the responsibility and shoulder the responsibility of ensuring those that live with us, that are most closest to us, also embody the ideals that will ensure a righteous afterlife. And I say this because we find ourselves challenged by those most near to us to many a times accept and to come to agreement with how we want to orient our lives and how we want to act in life. And I know this seems to be a very odd and alienistic statement, but it's not, because we have certain values in life and we hope to establish family on the basis of those values. But I think the experience of life tells us that it's a lot more difficult to raise a family that is protected and that actually lives in accordance to those ideals and those beliefs that we have in our minds, at least. How they turn out in practice sometimes is very different from what we envision our familial life will be like. Okay, so the first verse that I read from Surah At-Tahrim, and the occasion that this verse was revealed, one of the companions of the Prophet heard this, In the hadith narrated from Salih alayhi salatu wasalam, who she states, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. لما نزلت هذه الآية يا أيها الذين آمنوا قوا أنفسكم وأهليكم نارا جلس رجل من المسلمين يبكي. Someone heard this and this person began to cry and weep. And this is actually it's supposed to be a normal reaction that the Quran speaks about mu'mineen or people who their hearts, when they hear verses of punishment, the hearts become, you know, softened and they begin to contemplate about what their afterlife will look like. And many of them will actually begin to weep about what my future will look like. And when they hear the blessings of the paradise, they become happy and hopeful. So this person heard this verse and became really anxious and began to cry. وَقَالَ أَنَا عَجَزْتُ عَنْ نَفْسِي كُفِّلْتُ أَهْلِي. He says, the verse now came down. I personally have a hard time ensuring that I'm going to live a righteous life. Now the verse is coming to also task me with ensuring that my family also live a righteous life. So it seems to be too much for him to bear. And he asks now, why is this extra burden being put on me if I already have trouble taking care of myself? Many of us find ourselves in a position like this. I personally find myself in a position like this. I have to be responsible for myself, so making sure I do the things that I'm supposed to do and not do the things that I'm supposed to do. And I already have a hard time doing that. Now as the head of the family, I'm responsible also for the conduct and the actions of my children, my offspring. Why should I have to shoulder that responsibility? So he asked, what am I supposed to do here? If I can't take care of myself, what is the easiest way to ensure that I can, you know, successfully perform this responsibility that the Quran now says? فَقَالَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ وَسَلَّمُ. Give a very simple answer, very simple formula. And this is the formula for a successful life. And I know we've all heard this, but really coming back to the basics is the most important thing. Because we're here not to uncover new material. I can tell you, you've heard these things over and over and over. And any other person that you bring that is studied or not studied, whatever, they're not going to uncover a new book. You know, in my studies, I found this new book that no one knew about, and this is the material in it, and now if you just know this, everything will be okay. That's not what's going to happen. The Prophet gave a very simple answer, and his answers, for the most part, were very simple, but deep. He says, حَسْبُكَ أَن تَأْمُرَهُمْ بِمَا تَأْمُرَ بِهِ نَفْسَكَ وَتَنَهَاهُمْ عَمَّا تَنَهَا عَنْهُ نَفْسَكَ. The only thing you need to do, that if you can ensure success for yourself, this will also ensure success for your family, is that just oblige them, encourage them to do the things that you encourage yourself to do, and forbid them to not do the things that you forbid yourself to do. It's as simple as that. What standard do you hold yourself to? Hold your family to that same standard. What are the things that you encourage yourself to do? Whether you do them or not, that's the second level. What are the ideals? What are the standards? What are the goals and objectives that you set for your own life? What are the things that you don't ever want to do? Where are your red lines in life? So whatever those are, at least theoretically, define that theoretically for your family as well. So if theoretically, you're okay with being untruthful, then you should also be okay with your family not necessarily being truthful people. If it is a standard in your life to ensure that you pray, and you pray on time, then you should hold your family to that same standard for them to pray and pray on time. So, this idea of practicing what you preach, really raising children or raising a family or establishing a family, is as simple as the formula the Holy Prophet has told us. Whatever you do yourself, encourage others to do, especially your family. And what we read from this is that whatever you do yourself, your family will only hold themselves to that standard. So it's one thing to tell them. In the context of the hadith, the Prophet said, tell them. تَأْمُرَهُمْ. Encourage them, oblige them, command them. But also, the result of this is that whatever you end up doing in practice, your family will only hold themselves up to that standard. That means you will be responsible, you will be asked about the standards that you set in place in your family based on your actions. Your words are, of course, there, but your actions will be the ones that speak higher than this. Now, what we're trying to take away from this is that, okay, we look to the life of Lady Fatima salamu alayha, and she lived the perfect life. She stands at the top. It's the peak and the apex of what it means to live a righteous life. That we know.
But it's the idea of not just what she said, but how she practiced. And then specifically for us is that how much do our family structures and our family philosophies mirror that of the family of Layla Fatima? That's what's most important here. So we come to hopefully take away a few of these things. So her family was a family that resembled the Qur'an because we know them to be the speaking Qur'an, the living Qur'an. We have a silent Qur'an, which is the text that we read. We have a living Qur'an, which is the example of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So this is one of the verses of the Holy Qur'an that speaks about a successful family. Some of the characteristics that a righteous family is supposed to have. In Surah Anbiya, verses 89 and 90, when it speaks about the request that Nabi Zakariya alayhi salatu wasalam made, وَزَكَرِيَّ إِذْ نَادَ رَبَّهُ رَبِّ لَا تَذَرْنِي فَرْدًا وَأَنْتَ خَيْرُ الْوَارِثِينَ So the request that he made was, O Allah, do not leave me alone. Do not leave me without an heir. And indeed, you are the best of inheritors. Okay, so the first thing that Zakariya alayhi salam is asking, give me I want a family. I don't want to be without children. So he's requesting God to give him now. Now with that comes a responsibility. فَاسْتَجَبْنَا لَهُ So we answered his prayer. وَوَهَبْنَا لَهُ يَحْيَوْا So we gave him يَحَوْلَ عَلَيْهِ صَلَاتُ وَسْلَامُ وَأَسْلَحْنَا لَهُ زَوْجَهُ And we cured for him his wife's infertility. إِنَّهُمْ كَانُوا Now the family structure was like this. يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ Number one. They were active and they were on the front foot of going after the righteous work. وَيَدْعُونَنَا رَغَبًا وَرَهَبًا And they called upon us, they would supplicate us, but their supplication had two states. One was they were eager, رَغَبًا, تَرْغِيبًا, but also رَهَبًا. They were also anxious, they were fearful. وَكَانُوا لَنَا خَاشِعِينَ And indeed they were humble before us. So look, the family was organized around this idea. يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ When there was something good to be done, the family as a whole had this philosophy that we would run towards that. So if an opportunity presented itself to do something good, they all, with this unspoken language, understood that this is what we stand for and this is what we're going to do. So number one, يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ So this is the first principle that exists within the family of a person who's trying to live righteously and resemble that of the Qur'anic family and the family of Lady Fatima. يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ How, to what extent do we think of ourselves as people who يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ That we're not that if there's something good to do and someone comes and asks us and you know really begs us to do it, there's something that needs to be done, there's someone in need, we really need help, here's a GoFundMe page, here's another page to raise money. That's good. That's when khairat is there and people are asking you to do it. You respond. So that's a reactive form of engaging with khairat. There's a proactive form. And this is the proactive form. That means people go out actively looking for it. Where are the things that need to be done? Where are the problems that exist? How can I address that problem? Am I capable of addressing that problem? It's a proactive attitude that a person has. They don't wait for others to come and tell them. The reason for that is that some of the problems in the world, we're going to hear about them, but many of them we're not going to hear about them. So a person who does not have this proactive mentality of going after and finding where the problems of the world are, or the community are, or the family are, and actively seeking to address them, they're going to miss out on a lot of these opportunities. And what's going to happen? The person's going to say, why didn't you help so-and-so? We're going to be questioned, right? Why didn't you help so-and-so? Why didn't you address this problem? No, I didn't know. The first response is going to be, why didn't you know? Right? We know this famous story of ulama, right? One of the great ulama said he came to one of his students. I'm forgetting the names. I wasn't intending to mention the story, but it just came in my mind. Ulama says that one of his great students, one day his neighbor comes and he complains that he has a need. And then the next day, the dad, he calls him forward and he says that I heard your neighbor's needy. He doesn't have food to eat at night. And so, well, I didn't know. And he said, of course you didn't know. If you did know, not only would I not consider you my sinner, I wouldn't consider you Muslim. Because from the Hadith of the Holy Prophet, he says a person who sleeps at night and their neighbor is needy, hungry, and they don't address it, that person cannot consider themselves Muslim. So this is one of those states of, I was ignorant of the fact, but that ignorance itself is not acceptable. So يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ is an attitude of being proactive and going and helping people. So that's number one. وَيَدْعُونَنَا رَغَبًا وَرَهَبًا So there's an attitude of supplication, of prayer, of turning to God and asking for help. Collectively, the family is like this. Not just the head of the family is the father, for example. Or the mother. A lot of families, there's an imbalance like that. Like you have an irreligious father, and you have a really religious mother. And then the father doesn't care about the religious upbringing of the children, but the mother is extra sensitive about those things. Or the opposite of that. So that family, when it has an imbalance, obviously what's going to be established, the children are going to be trained not to have a balanced attitude towards the sarah. Even after doing these things, it means, look, these are people who are trying their best to help others. And they're on point when it comes to their supplication, their prayers, their dua. But at the same time, they were humble before us. That means they don't get arrogant and boastful now. Yeah, we are the ones who are solving everyone's problem. We are the ones. No, they're so humble. In Surah At-Tur, again, the model family. وَأَقْبَلَ بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَىٰ وَعْضٍ يَتَسَاءَلُونَ. He's talking about the Day of Judgment when now the people who have entered the paradise, they're going to converse with one another. They say about the Quran speaks about both the people who enter paradise and also the people who enter the hell. They have conversations with one another. So the people in hell are going to ask each other, what are you doing here? Why did you end up here? What reason do you have to end up here? And also, the people of the paradise will ask each other, what got you here? وَأَخْبَرَ بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَىٰ بَعْضٍ يَتَسَاءَلُونَ. They will turn to one another questioning each other. قَالُوا إِنَّا كُنَّا قَبْلُ فِي أَهْلِنَا مُشْفِقِينَ. What made you end up here in paradise? They will respond to one another, indeed, aforetime, before, we used to be apprehensive about our families. That means we were careful with how we managed the family. We were careful about the structure of the family. We were careful about our children. What are our children doing? Where are our children going? What are our children hearing? What are our children seeing? Who are our children conversing with? Who are our children spending their time with? We were on top of managing the family to make sure that, because we know ourselves to be responsible for them, we have to answer. So we made sure it's not about micromanaging, but it's making sure that we have at least requisite control and knowledge of how the family is functioning. Okay, so a few of these things that we can remind ourselves to try and work on, because these are not things that you do once and then solidify. You have to work on it consistently. So the first thing we say, number two, this idea of halal sustenance, rizq. The halal sustenance doesn't come into the house, no successful righteous family is going to be established. They say we are what we eat. Spiritually, it's just as true. Whatever we put into our body, whatever we put on the table, our family will also develop their spiritual attitudes in accordance to what they consume. In Surah Baqarah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us, Ya ayyuhan nas, kulu mimma fil ardi halalan tayyiba. O people, O mankind, eat from whatever is lawful from the pure earth. Wala tattabi'u khutuwat ash-shaytan. And do not follow in Satan's steps. Innahu lakum aduwwun mubin. Indeed, he is a manifest enemy for you. So look how the sentence is structured. First it says, eat from what is halal, pure, lawful. Wala tattabi'u khutuwat. These are related to one another. It means shaitan will try his best, or any sort of satanic power, or the inner Satan, will try its best to get a person to deviate from that halal, that pure, that unquestionable, that without doubt sustenance that a person puts in their body and puts in the body of their children as well, their family as well. Shaitan will come as best as he can to try and sway you, to try and bring justifications of how, yeah, this may be questionable. Once you have doubt in your mind, he'll come and answer those questions. There's sometimes when a person has shak, doubt, okay? To remove the doubt, sometimes you turn to a source that is authentic, a source that is trustworthy, a source that will shoulder that responsibility, a source that is sure of itself. And there's another way a person can go to try to still answer the question, justify it, but that justification is not as strong. We find ourselves in this situation all the time. You're put in a gray area. What should I do? Depending on how we proceed, that shak, that doubt becomes haram. Or that shak becomes halal. So shaitan there is not he's not there to try and sway us to eat those things that we know is haram. He's going to try and present us as many suspicious encounters as possible. And once we find ourselves in that state of suspicion, A person has to have really a higher level of taqwa, of consciousness, of being conscious of God, to make sure that they relieve themselves of the doubt in a correct manner, in a correct attitude. So this is almost like a more complex way of addressing halal sustenance and halal earning and halal eating. One way you know this is halal, 100% I know, or I'm fairly sure. Then you have halal, I'm fairly sure. And then you have the things in the middle. Shaitan is going to work within that middle ground. No one's going to entice you and I to go eat haram food outside, obviously not. Or get a haram earning, but he's going to work on the places that we're unsure. And the Quran then instructs us, فَلْيَنْدُرِ الْإِنسَانَ إِلَّا تَعَوْمِ. Okay, so this halal sustenance, let me share a story as well from the ulama. And it's very interesting because sometimes we ask ourselves what went wrong. And the answer a lot of times is tied to this idea of sustenance and halal eating. So there's a story about Mirza Shirazi. Mirza Shirazi is a very famous contemporary scholar towards the middle and the end of the 19th century. He's very widely known for the tobacco protests that happened during the Qajar period, during the time of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. Okay, so one day, Mirza Shirazi is invited to the home of this Nasiruddin Shah. And he invites him for a meal. So Nasiruddin Shah wants to make conversation with Mirza Shirazi, so he asks him a question. He says, what's the reason that sometimes our children, and the children that come from loyalty, they become righteous people? They grow up in all of this, you know, like irreligious and corrupt environments, but they turn out to be good people. But at the same time, sometimes your children that grow up in all of these like spiritual environments, they end up becoming very corrupt people. And we see this from time to time. When I was a child, it was always so odd to me that at least this is a phenomenon during my day. I'm not sure. I'm not saying it's like this all the time. And God forbid, I don't want to make a generalization. But for some reason, like the children of like ulama or scholars or whatever, always used to be like the most rascal kids. There was always something wrong with them. Like you always found them doing the most questionable things. You found them always in the most questionable places. Or you never saw them at all. And then you figured out, yeah, they have children, but they never speak about them because they're screw-ups or whatever. So, Nasiruddin Shah is asking, what happens? Why do some ulama kids? Obviously, the righteous ulama will protect their families. Well, in any case, Mirza Shirazi responds like this. He said, the reason that I'm here now as a scholar, I'm your guest. And as your guest, I eat from your suspicious food. And I eat from your suspicious and your haram food. And what happens is, that impacts my children. I bring that into my family. I bring that into... So, they become corrupt through me not being conscious of what I'm eating, even as a guest in the house of another person. But your children, how do they end up becoming sometimes righteous people, that when I invite you to my house, they come and eat from my food. And from that pure food goes into their system that also plants a seed of righteousness within them, so they end up becoming good people. So the important thing to take away from this is sometimes we have, you know, we have all of the facets of making sure we live a nice life, a righteous life. But this idea of halal sustenance is such a complex and difficult one. We have to ensure as best as we can that we don't allow it to enter into our family, because we don't really know the outcome of what something like this will happen. I mean, when we know Lady Fatima Salamuna alayha, the Ahlul Bayt Allahumma salli alayhi wa sallam, they were extremely, extremely careful, not only about what they ate, but also to make sure not a penny or a single dinar, dirham, whatever, to enter the wealth that was questionable, that didn't belong to them. From the Baytul Mal, nothing comes into their wealth. Their wealth is their own, they don't mix it with anything. And they don't justify it either, right? We all heard the story of the Imam sitting and working, he has the candle on, and then the personal affair comes up and he turns off the candle and turns on the other one. Look, if I was in that position, this is what I would have said. Someone comes and is asking me a question, I'm working on Baytul Mal, and I'm counseling another person, so if anything, I'm providing a community service, so I keep this light on as well, and I also turn on the coffee pot, I make myself some coffee, and I turn on. So this is me justifying, this is me giving excuses about, I'm doing something good here, but I'm using the resources of things that don't belong to me. These are those small little things that build up and accrue, and then somehow it ends up, we do something that is so out of character, and then we question, well, what happened? It's these small things that really build up. Okay. From the life of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, this idea of establishing family, even from the stage that precedes that, her marriage. There's so many examples about this, but the one point that I want to take away, look, Lady Fatima had a lot of suitors. Everyone wanted to come and become the husband of Lady Fatima and become the, also the groom of the Prophet. Okay. So one after another, all of these great Sahaba and all of these very wealthy people, one after another came, and some of them began to compete with one another. So I'm going to give this kind of a dowry, and others said, well, I'll give more, and also I have more iman because I became Muslim first. So look, all these, like, the Prophet, you know, was offended obviously by all of this, and he pushed them away. But after Lady Fatima got married to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, you know, some of the ladies of Quraysh came to visit her. And the Prophet, after a few days after their wedding, came to visit Lady Fatima and Ali alayhi salatu wasalam one day. And he asked Imam Ali, can you just step out? I want to speak to her privately. So speaking to her, said, you know, how are things going? And she said, you know, things are great, essentially. She says that God has blessed me with the best of husbands. So when the woman of Quraysh come to visit me, instead of congratulating me, they tease me. And they say, your father chose for you a husband. He married you to a person that's poor. You had a number of very wealthy suitors, but your father chose a poor person for you. So, you know, so is your fate. So this, you know, she was saying that this, you know, this is what's happening. And the Prophet responded, your father and your husband are poor. By Allah, the treasures of the earth were presented to me, but I preferred the blessings of the afterlife to the pleasures of this world. I chose a husband for you that became a Muslim before anyone else, and a superior knowledge and wisdom than anyone else. God has chosen me and your husband from amongst his creations. You have a good husband, so cherish him. Do not defy his request. Okay, the moral is what? Our daughters may be named Fatima, but they're not at the same level of Lady Fatima salamu alayhi. And the husbands that come, maybe there's someone named Ali, but he's not at the level of Imam Ali. Okay. The point is that when it comes time for our children to establish their families as parents, and what eye are we looking at when the suitor comes? Let's be honest now, right? When the suitor comes and he has little of the material accomplishments and wealth, let's be honest with ourselves. If we look at him differently than the person who comes with a lot of wealth and a lot of, you know, car, house, nice job, all that stuff, then what we're doing is we're having that same kind of an attitude that these Quraysh and even Sahaba, these, they were Muslim too, the same kind of a mentality that they hadn't understood. What is at the crux of the religion? It's not to value or honor material wealth. It's not. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not that if someone has that, it's bad. But the point is, when a person comes, who do you envision to be a suitable suitor for your children? A person who's shown themselves to be mature, who has an earnest love for the religion, to better themselves, to educate themselves, and hopefully has their life on track? Or are we looking for the people who has everything, you know, everything is nice and ready and prepared, and we want, you know, we want that for our children? And these are the questions that we find over and over and over families struggling with when it comes to finding suitable mates for their children, or even the children themselves when they want to get married. What are those most important things that they're looking for? Usually these sorts of things about religiosity, they fall really low on our list. And not only when I say religiosity, I don't mean the person who resembles us exteriorly, superficially. They have the same name, the same madhab, and they come to the same masjid, or come from the same, you know, like religious background or religious culture. No, that's not what I'm talking about. We shouldn't be too nitpicky when it comes to these things. That means if a person has the foundation of what it means to be a good person, and they show promise in being able to manage a righteous family, that's the thing we should be looking for. That means how much promise or potential does this person, this man, this woman, show as a potential husband or wife in managing a righteous family? Because managing a righteous family, part of it is financial for sure, but part of it is to have that maturity, the education, the desire, the drive to be يُصَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ, to be وَيَدْعُونَ رَحْبًا وَرَغْبًا وَكَانُوا لَنَا خَاشِينَ. These are the invaluables. These are some of the things that you can't teach them. It means when it comes to that level, these are the things that we need to be looking for. And sometimes we have to make sure that we don't wait for the perfect candidate and the perfect suitor to come. One of the companions wrote to Imam Jawad alayhi salatu wasalam regarding this issue. And he said that I have a daughter, I can't find anyone suitable for her. I mean, someone that kind of like ticks all of the boxes that I'm looking for in a potential suitor. So the Imam responds to him and says, I heard what you had to say. وَأَنَّكَ لَا تَجِدُ أَحَدًا مِثْلَكَ فَلَا تَنْظُرْ فِي ذَلِكَ رَحِمَكَ اللَّهُ. Don't worry about this thing. He said, don't worry about this. Don't wait on this. فَإِنَّ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ قَالْ إِذَا جَاءَكُمْ مَنْ تَرَذَّوْنَ خُلُقَهُ وَدِينَهُ فَزَوَّجُوهُ إِلَّا تَفْعَلُوهُ تَكُنْ فِتْنَةٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَفَسَادٌ كَبِيرٌ. The Prophet instructed us, when a person came, that their mannerisms were pleasing to you, their religion was good, the foundation for the religion was good, then marry your children off. Or in this case, marry your daughter to that kind of a person. Otherwise you may run the risk of the effects when a person is not able to find their match at an appropriate time. And this is a very real concern as well. One is that, okay, your child may not be able to protect themselves, and then it leads them to all these other, you know, mischiefs and misbehaviors, and that's one issue. But also, there's so much detriment and pressure and tension that is also brought about when a person hasn't found the perfect mate yet, the perfect suitor yet, but plenty of people that have the foundation, the potentials in raising that righteous family. So this is also something to consider as well. The Prophet was very easygoing, at least in what he considered to be the requirements for a suitable mate. Moving on to the next point. So one is that in the establishment of the family, prioritizing what things are most important. There's another story from the life of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam when he was a young boy. This is another one of the elements of a righteous family and a family that is working together collectively. So when Imam Hassan was a young boy, he said around 7 years old, young kid, he was instructed by his parents, specifically Fatima, that when the Prophet would enter the masjid and they would have sessions or majalis, that essentially you would lead prayer, you would lecture, for them to go as well. Obviously 7 years old now may be different from 7 years old then, but still, point is true. So Muhammad Hassan would go, he would attend the prayer, he would be in the masjid during that time, and he would listen to the lecture and the sermon of the Prophet when he sat on the minbar. And then when he would come home, his mother, Lady Fatima, would start asking him, inquiring, what did the Prophet say today in the minbar? What ayahs of the Qur'an were revealed today? What are the new verses of the Qur'an that God has revealed to the Prophet? So they start having this dialogue, and in some of the accounts they say that Muhammad Hassan would sit as if he's like re-delivering the speech. He's acting like his grandfather, he sits and he's delivering his speech as well in the house, and Lady Fatima would listen. And sometimes Muhammad Ali would come and see that Lady Fatima was aware of the contents of the speech that was presented, the khutbah of the Prophet that was presented in the masjid, but she wasn't present, she was in the house. And he asked, how do you know this? He said, well, my son Imam Hassan came and he was repeating these things and we had a discussion about these. Alright, there's more to this story, but this is what the only point I want to pick up. So what's the moral of this story? The role of the mother, the role of the father when it comes to their children's, not just religious education, but education as a whole. Number one, first, obviously, these are the things that we've all been talking about. Alhamdulillah, I think we have something like this here. We have to have educational programs for our children in a religious context. That's understood. That's taken for granted. So I'm not gonna really beat that horse very much. But this idea of sharing with each other what we learn is extremely important in making sure everyone in the family, this righteous family, is on the same page. We hear a lot of things, we process a lot of things, but verbalizing that, communicating that a lot, it's very important to make sure not only that we've understood it correctly, but in that dialogue we come to understanding with one another. So, the child has come home from outside, let's say they haven't gone to a majlis or a minbar, let's say they've gone to school. Your child comes home from school. Having a conversation with them is extremely important. Not only about what did you learn today, to make sure they were listening in school, that's one thing, that's fine. Those are at the end of the semester when they bring their report cards and they see all the A's, that's fine. That's not what's important, that's a part of it. But what did you learn in school today? How do you feel about the things that you learned in school today? Tell me. To have that conversation is extremely important. Not only the children with the parents, and this is the parents may need to take the lead, but also the parents with the kids as well, to share these life experiences with them. You know, this is what happened in my day today. Not all of it may be pertinent to the child, but sharing some of that and progressively adding to that prepares the child to know what the challenges of life are, but also know where you are in the state of your life right now. When we're talking about, I don't know what's going on in my child's life, you know, I think they're hiding things from me, they don't seem to be in a very good mood, I think they're depressed, I think they're whatever. Okay, well, the starting points of these things is when we, the lines of communication break down. But it's not always the children sharing with the parents, because that seems unfair. If you're always asking to receive but never share yourself, a person is going to get tired. It's like a one-way conversation. And many times parents fail to realize this, that your children should also be your conversation partners. Not that you're teaching them necessarily something, but you're also sharing with them your emotions, your feelings. So the children can also sympathize. And the older they get, the more we have to share with them. To understand some of the challenges and the struggles and the difficulties of life. When children are not respectful of the sacrifices parents make, a part of it is because they're spoiled, a part of it is because they're immature, a part of it is because of this generation, a part of it is because, you know, they live in this country, in this culture. Yeah, all of those things are faults and problems. But at least we can add to one of these is that the failures that we have to communicate with our kids, to tell them, I had a hard day at work today, and this is why. My boss did this to me, my coworker did this to me, or I'm really tired from traveling. You know, like I had to take a flight this long, I had to get up this early. All of these things, this idea of sharing with one another where we are, that brings a togetherness, that brings a closeness that we can't gain from other places. So, if we want to develop an understanding with one another, that we can work collectively together in a family that wants to pursue certain goals, certain ideals, to live as a righteous family, this idea of communication becomes extremely important. Alright, so this is another example that we have about communicating what we've learned with one another. Another interesting point that I just want to add on to this is a small story from the life of Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha. There's a story narrated that Lady Zainab, of course, she's known, well known as Aqila bin Hashim, very sharp young lady. So she one day was reciting Quran in the house, and Amir Mu'mineen was there, and she heard her reciting. And they come and sit together now, aside from the fact that we should kind of be reading Quran together as a family, aside that point. So she starts asking questions. She's reading this Quran and she asks questions. So she asks her father about the tafsir of certain verses. And the Imam is sharing with her, and he's really, you know, he's taken aback, he's, you know, about really how sharp and incisive her mind is. So Imam Ali says, you know, I want to inform you of some of the challenges that will come later in your life. So these are the things where not only parental advice, but also perhaps some of that knowledge that, you know, the sacred knowledge that they have of informing them, these are the challenges that will come in your life, so prepare yourself. So Imam Ali is telling me, I feel like you're mature enough, I want to share this with you. And then Lady Zainab responds that my mother, Fatima salamullah alayha, has already informed me and prepared me for these events that you're talking about. So imagine, not only is Ali alayhi salam as the father coming and saying that I know some of the challenges that will come to you as a young woman living in this society, I want to prepare you for them. Okay? You and I don't have foreknowledge. You know, we don't have the prescience of what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't have those things, that's fine. But we know what, at least some of the challenges of a young woman will be in this society, I hope, of what a young man's challenges will be in this society, to sit our children down from time to time and say, these are the kind of life lessons that I want to share with you, I want to pass on to you. Or also, I want to prepare you for what your tomorrow is going to look like. So how many conversations really have we had with our children where we sit them down, aside from censuring them, aside from, you know, criticizing them, sitting down and say, this is what I think your tomorrow is going to look like. These are the things that I think I need you to prepare yourself today for them. So tomorrow, when that opportunity, when that event, when that choice presents itself, I can at least have some confidence that you're going to make an informed decision, an informed choice. Really, how much are we preparing our children for the challenges of life? And specifically within the context of the environment and the society that they're living in. When it comes to family matters, when it comes to marriage, when it comes to being a parent, these are things we pick up. We speak to newlyweds, we speak to younger people. The parents have never sat them down to discuss these things. Never. Like all of the other side, secondary, tertiary things, in great detail they discuss, right? Like especially when a person is getting married. All the way down to the flowers and the colors and the schema, all of these things, they over and over go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They know, right? But when it comes to, how are you supposed to conduct yourself with your spouse? Nothing. Absolute silence. What are you supposed to do if your spouse shows anger and you know that it's not justified? What are you supposed to do when a person starts getting abusive, they get out of line? What are you supposed to do? How do I ensure that I show my kindness, my love to my children? So for whatever reason, none of these things are being discussed. So the legacy of the Ahlul Bayt tells us that the conversations they were having with one another was not, I'm the chosen man, you are the chosen woman, I am the chosen successor of the Prophet, you are the chosen child of mine. It wasn't, they weren't just sitting and having conversations of I'm greater and you're greater. No. And they weren't competing with one another either. They were saying, these are the hardships of my life. Because as much as they were masoom, all of their lives were lives of difficulty, of tragedy, of hardship, of struggle, of injustice. It wasn't a perfect, flowery ideal. It wasn't. Which makes it even more interesting and perhaps ironic that we live in times of extreme difficulty and struggle. Many of us, some of us more than others. But for whatever reason, we forget this part as well. And this is one of the reasons why I chose to just share some of these things. Again, my point is not that the fadawal are not important. They're extremely important. They're most important. But if all we stick to are those things, what it makes is it creates a disconnect. They were like that, but we are not like that. But we miss even the most practical things that they practice in their lives, of preparing their children for the tomorrow that they know will come. If you look in Nahjul Balagha, look, letter 31 that Amir al-Mu'minin writes to his son, most of our scholars believe to be Imam al-Hasan alayhi salatu wasalam, read the letter. What is he writing to him? Min al-walid al-fan. I'm a father who's, I feel my death is near. I have to share these truths with you. I think that you're at a time in your life that I need to prepare you for the challenges of tomorrow. Read the letter, what the Imam is writing, in great detail, for a young man, an impressionable man. So how much of this are we sharing with our children? How many of these wills are we writing for ourselves outside of, when I die, my estate goes to this person, and you know, the money in the bank goes to that person, and this is how much salat I have, and this is how much, you know, of the sawm you have to make, and this is how much of the hajj that I didn't do. Yeah, those things are important too, but how, in these terms, of preparing our children for tomorrow? Prasad salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So this idea of not only learning together, but being aware and conscious of what it is that we are learning, and preparing each other for the tomorrows that will undoubtedly come. Okay. Another example that I want to share is the idea of, they build on one another. One day the Holy Prophet came to the house of Lady Fatima salamu alayha, and as he came, he finds her standing by the door, and she's anxious, she's concerned, she's worried. And the Prophet asks, why are you standing here, and what's wrong? And Lady Fatima says that, from the early morning, my young children, they've left the house, and I don't know where they are. I don't have news from them, I don't know where they are, I don't know if they're safe, I don't know if they're in trouble, so I'm worried. As a mother, obviously, naturally I'm worried. So the Prophet said, okay. So he goes out and he starts looking for them, and he gets close to the cave of the mountain of Jabal, and he sees the two of them. They're all healthy, they're safe, they're playing with one another. But their mother was unaware of their whereabouts. So he collected both of them and they went back home and he took them home. Okay, simple story. Moral. Moral story is number one. During those times there were no devices, communicative devices, to make sure we let each other know where we are. But the concern of the mother here right now is the first point of reflection. The mother obviously is concerned, where are my children? Now, every mother, every father, I would hope as well, when they're concerned about the whereabouts of their children, the safety usually is one of the first things that come up. Are my children safe? Are my kids safe? I don't know what happened. They were supposed to be home by now. Where are they? I'm worried. And usually mine goes to the most, you know, the worst possible scenario. That God forbid, someone abducted them and murdered them, or they got into this fiery car crash, or whatever. Inshallah, none of that happens ever. But that's where the mind goes. Okay, so that's good, that's natural. But what about when it doesn't get to that point yet about, oh my God, my kids have died. What about before that? Like, where are my kids right now? What are they doing? I don't have detailed knowledge of what exactly it is that my kids are doing. Again, I'm not endorsing helicopter parenting, but there's also another polar opposite to that of just like being completely indifferent. Yeah, I trust my kids. My kids are out, they'll be home. In these time spans that we write off to my kids at the library. So I'm telling you, when I was in college, for whatever reason, me and all of my college mates were always at the library when we weren't at home. I'm not a very studious person. Yeah, I don't study it like many college students. I crammed the night before. And I did okay enough that it didn't, you know, it didn't warrant that much attention from my parents. For the most part, A's, maybe from time and again, a B, and my father would kind of get on my case, what's going on here? Oh, I'll study more, the class is harder, give all these excuses, right? But whenever I wasn't home, right in front of my parents so that they could see and observe me, I was at the library. So you have sometimes simplistic, naive parents. Oh, my kid, you know, okay, yes, have a good opinion of your child, trust your child. But when your child is 16 hours of the day at the library, you should know. From time to time, just go check on the library. You can go read a book too from time to time. Make sure your kid's in that library. They may be somewhere else. So being concerned of where your kids are or how they're spending their time is extremely important as well. Informing each other of our whereabouts. This is something that parents all the time, they complain about. My kids don't tell me where they are. This is something that like the communication has to be open. For transparent with where we are and what we're doing, number one, it brings ease. It brings trust. It brings a togetherness. But also it can act as a repellent, right? It can act as a protector. And it deters us from doing certain things that we're not supposed to do. If I'm an honest person and I say I'm going to do this, when I get tempted to do something I'm not supposed to do, to go somewhere I'm not supposed to go, the simple fact that I know that I'm being transparent, and this transparency is an important pillar of what it means to live in that family unit, and that itself will hopefully act as a deterrent to make sure I don't do those things. Why? Because people know. This is where they are. I don't have any doubt in my mind. A lot of these crazy ideas that spouses get from one another, I'm assuming in culture outside of our own, but sometimes it exists in our culture as well. You know, I'm getting suspicious of my spouse. Where are they? What are they doing? It doesn't always have to be the worst. Again, the mind doesn't always have to go to the worst possible. But this comes in the mind. Person gets suspicious, has doubts. How can we relieve those doubts, ease those doubts? Just communication. Where are they? What are they doing? Who are they spending their time with? You'd be amazed how many parents don't know who their children's friends are. They just don't know. And if they do know, maybe a first name basis. Yeah, my child hangs out with Hassan, Ali, and John. Who are they? Who are their parents? Where do they live? Where do they go to school? Where do they... Nothing. And then the day will come where the ultimate reveal comes, that the parent, the spouse, the father, the mother, or the child find something out that they were not expecting, and then all hell breaks loose. What happened? So keeping those lines of communication is extremely important. That will at least ensure that we don't get surprised with something. We're at least observant of those things. When we're observant, we can say, I know this is happening. I'd like to change it, or I'm trying to change it, but at least I know that it's happening. It hopefully nips in the bud this tendency of people to conceal things that they feel are contradictory to whatever those standards are. Look, if a family collectively has this attitude that it's okay to lie, it's okay to cheat, it's okay to backbite, so then they'll do it openly in front of each other. There's no reason to conceal or hide that. But when they know there's a different standard and a person wants to act differently, essentially be a hypocrite, they'll try their best to conceal it to make sure nobody finds out about what those faults are. So how much of our family nucleus, although externally we look, mashallah, nice Muslim family, righteous, come to the masjid, but how much of that really is There's a hypocrisy internally within that brewing. And if that goes unaddressed now, those larger, grander ideals that the family has, and especially the children have later on when they establish their own, when those are lost, that's because they're really not addressed in the earlier stages of a person's life. Recite salawat ala Muhammad wa ali. So I think I'll end here, but I'll just kind of summarize and wrap up what we said to ensure that when you go home tonight and have conversations with the children of what we talked about, we can have clear conversations. So what we did tonight, we just went over a few of the practical examples of how in the life of Lady Fatima salamu ala alayha, her children, her spouse, how that family was a family that was righteous, number one. Their righteous family was established on these pillars. Number one, يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ they ran after, they proactively went after doing good deeds, helping others, helping themselves. They were also people who were, that their spiritual life was active, not only with love, with eagerness, but also they had a fear. They also had a worry and a concern that, what if we're not actually doing all the things that we need to? That means it's a questioning, it's a reflection of the self. I think I'm doing everything right, but I'm not certain. I always have to look again at it. And then about the family structure, a family being one that is conscious and cognizant, is protected. إِنَّا كُنَّا قَبْلُ فِي أَهْلِنَا مُشْفِقِينَ. The idea of being mushfiq, apprehensive of the family, of one another. The halal earning, the halal sustenance, to ensure that what we're bringing inside the house, what we're feeding our children, what we're putting into our system spiritually, is one that is halal. There's no doubt in it. Again, moving forward, when it comes to establishing families, do we hold others that want to enter into this family of righteousness, do we hold them to the same standard that we hold ourselves to? That means if we believe ourselves to be righteous, if we want an outsider, for example, to come to join the family, to become the husband of our daughter, become the wife of our sons, do they also reflect and embody the attitudes and the characteristics that we have? Or do they mirror them in the hypocritical way that we have them as well? We hold ourselves to be great people, and they hold themselves to be great people exteriorly, but internally they're decaying. Internally we're decaying as well. Learning with one another, sharing what we learn with one another, being communicative in what we learn, in what we hear, in what we think about, in what we feel, sharing our emotions with one another, learning to growing together, and preparing ourselves and our children for the tomorrow that will most definitely come. And finally, being aware of where our children are, being conscious of how and where our children spend their time, our spouses spend their time. And in trying to communicate more openly with one another, that we can feel fully and honestly comfortable and satisfied with the family that we have, satisfied with the relationship that we have, satisfied with the marriage that we have, satisfied with the relationship of the father, the mother with their children, the relationship that we have. And not always complain about how, you know, nothing is going right. Look, when Amina alayhi salatu wasalam, Lady Fatima, towards the end of her life, they had these conversations with one another. Lady Fatima, towards the end of her life, when she was having a conversation to make sure that husband and wife, they were both on the same page. Lady Fatima in her will writes a number of things. I don't want to get into that. But this is one of the conversations they had. Lady Fatima addresses Imam Ali, she says, قالت يا ابن عمي ما أحدتني كاذبا ولا خائنا ولا خالفتك منذ عاشرتني. This is a definitive statement, she says. And she says this with full confidence. Number one, in the life that we had together, even though it was a short life, you didn't find me with these qualities. I wasn't a liar. ما أحدتني كاذبا. I was a truthful person. I was honest in our relationship. Not honest only in the lies, but honest in the relationship that I had with you. My love was true. My affection was true. Performing my responsibilities was with honesty, was with trust. I did not dishonor the nature of our relationship. I was an honorable person. So, not only understanding what the foundations of the relationship is on, but also honoring that. This is not an easy thing. And for a spouse towards the end of their life to turn around and say this so definitively, that I wasn't this kind of a person. I was honorable to the covenant of this relationship, of this righteous family, of the ideals that we stood for. I did those things, not only in the presence of others, but also in private as well. I was honorable to those things. So, as a husband, we should be thinking on a night like this that we're commemorating the martyrdom of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. How definitively can we make a statement like this if we turn to our spouse and say, I was honest to you. I was honest in our relationship. Turn to your kids and say, I was honest. I was honest in trying to be the best father. The father that established the foundation and the pillar of what it means to live in a righteous family. I was honest. I was honest in that I brought halal and purified sustenance in the house. I didn't make excuses about I want my family to live comfortably, and then, and hence because of that, I started getting into suspicious. No, I was honest to that. If I was able to provide little, it's because I was honest. If I was able to provide the Muslim, because I was honest. وَلَا خَائِنَا, I did not dishonor you. وَلَا خَالَفْتُكَ مُنْدُ عَشَرْتَنِي, and we did not have disagreements or disputes. I never disobeyed your command. So it's not even necessarily about one commanding the other, or one ordering the other, and one being in charge, one being on top and the other being subservient. That's not the point here. The point is that we had an understanding with one another. I held up my end. And I can confidently say that. So we should also be thinking, the agreements that we made with one another, when we were getting married, during the marriage with our children, all of those discussions that we had, all of the understandings that we had, this is how I want the family structure to be, this is how I want the children to be raised, this is how I want my spiritual state to be, this is how I want, these are the ideals that I want to be passed on to my children, I want my children to inherit these things. I didn't disobey, I didn't, you know, leave the course. And a lot of marriages and a lot of families struggle with that. There is not this uniformity. You have a father and a mother that are striving really, really hard, but for whatever reason, a child that just wants to go in a completely different direction. This is a person who has done mukhalafa. They have not been honest. They have not been truthful. You have a mother and a child that are trying really hard, but the father, for whatever reason, wants to move in a different direction, doesn't want to hold them up to that same standard. Or any other different scenario you have. The family can only stay successfully righteous if everyone understands, acknowledges, and commits to holding themselves to that standard they've set. If the person, if the family decides, we don't want to be a righteous family, no problem, that's okay. It's for you to decide. You will be responsible to answer for yourselves. But if the family collectively says, we want to live at this level, we want to be followers, lovers, we want to be the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt, that's a standard that you set for yourself. That's a standard that the family sets for itself. And not only are we mourning the martyrdom of Lady Fatima on a night like this, but also we should be thinking about, perhaps lamenting, many of our personal failures that we've had, that we are collectively also a family, we belong to the family of this Ahlul Bayt. We see Lady Fatima not as just some great woman, not as just some great companion, not as just some great Muslima, not as just some great wife, not as just some great mother, but our affection, our love that we have towards her is because we see ourselves included in that family, that spiritual family. And tonight we see ourselves as being orphaned. We're not here as we attend the funerals or the processions of others. We are here to mourn ourselves, because tonight we are the ones who are. We are the family that is mourning. If we can dim the lights and prepare for the musibah. We are losing a mother tonight. And hence we think, Ya Fatima, you were honest to us. You were truthful with us. You are and undoubtedly will hold up your end, Ya Fatima, but here tonight I say that I find myself falling short. I see myself included in this family, but I find myself moving in a different direction. Ya Fatima, just like you cared for Hassan and Hussein, Zainab Umm Kulthum, do you also stand by the door of your house tonight asking, where is my child? Do you also inquire from the Holy Prophet where your children, where we are in the state of our affairs, why we have gone so far and not returned? As-salamu alayki ya Fatima al-Zahra, ya bint Muhammad, ya qurrat ayn al-Rasul.
يا سيدتنا ومولاتنا إنا توجهنا واستشفعنا وتوسلنا بك إلى الله وقدمناك بين يدي حاجاتنا يا وجيهة عند الله اشفعي لنا عند الله يا وجيهة عند الله اشفعي لنا عند الله ساعدك الله ساعد الله قلبك يا أبا الحسن Oh my master, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, our condolences on the night that we commemorate the martyrdom of Lady Fatima. Ya mumtahanatum ta'anakillah alladhi khalaqaki qabla yakhluqak. O Fatima, Allah had tested your essence before He created you and saw you worthy. فَوَجَدَكِ لِمَامْ تَحَنَكِ صَابِرًا He found you to be a patient servant. O Fatima, O Mother, Allah tested you and found you patient. How patient were you after the death of the Holy Prophet? Day after day, night after night, Lady Fatima would go and mourn. Lament the passing of her beloved, the Holy Prophet. وَزَعَمْنَا أَنَّا لَكِ أَوْلِيَاءُ وَمُصَدِّقُونَ وَصَابِرُونَ لِكُلِّ مَا أَتَانَا بِهِ أَبُوكِ صلى الله عليه وآله وأتى به وصيُّه فَإِنَّا نَسْأَلُكِ إِن كُنَّا صَدَّقْنَاكِ إِلَّا أَلْحَقْتِنَا بِتَصْدِيقِنَا لَهُمَا لِنُبَشِّرَ أَنفُسَنَا بِأَنَّا قَدْ تَهُرْنَا بِوَلَايَتِكَ Oh my mother, O Lady Fatima, on a night like this, as I remember your tragedy and I remember your martyrdom, I beg you, I call on you, Do not abandon me and be patient with this child of yours. I have dishonored you. I was untruthful. I disobeyed your instruction and your teaching and training. Ya Fatima, I've been a bad child of yours, but I know you will be patient with me. I'm here tonight to ask you, do not leave me alone. I have difficulties, I have troubles, I have challenges. I ask you to intercede on my behalf, to help me, oh mother. Lady Fatima's life was one grief after another. After the passing of her father, the Holy Prophet, Lady Fatima did not have a single night where she rested comfortably. She mourned so much that the city became unrested with her cries. They would complain, Fatima, is this not enough? Are your cries not enough? Are your laments not enough? But Fatima's cries were not only for the passing of her father. Fatima's grief were not only because of the passing of the Holy Prophet. But Fatima could see how they were treating her imam. Fatima was a witness to the distrust and disloyalty of the community of the Prophet. Only days after the passing of the Prophet, these people turned against his command as an instruction. It came a point in time that they decided to go forward with their affairs. They came to the house of Ali to take him, for him to also give allegiance.
Ali had promised the Holy Prophet to remain in the house until he compiled the Holy Quran. As these wretched men came to the house of Ali, in one of the letters that Allama Majlisi narrates, that the second caliph writes to Muawiyah, he writes of the events of the day that they came to the house of Ali to get his allegiance. Among the contents of this letter is written, this man writes, I went to the house of Ali, bent on getting him out of it. I said to the maid of the house, Fidda, tell Ali to come out to swear allegiance to the caliph, since all the other Muslims have already given their allegiance. Fidda responded, Amirul Mu'mineen is busy now. I responded to her, leave such talks aside and tell him to come out, or else we shall enter and get him out by force. It was at this time that Lady Fatima comes to the door and stands behind the door. She comes to protect the Imam of her time. She comes to stand for the Wilaya and comes to stand for justice. Fatima cries out, oh you folks of misguidance and falsehoods, what is it that you're saying and what is it that you want? This man responded, oh Fatima. Fatima responded, what is it that you want? I said, what is wrong with your cousin Abu al-Hasan? Why did he send you to answer the door as he sits behind inside the house? Fatima responds, it is your own oppression and wretchedness that has forced me to come out thus, and has tied you to the evidence as well as every misguided deviator. This man responded, leave these talks aside and woman fables aside and tell Ali, your husband, to come out. Fatima responds, no love to you from us, nor respect. Are you scaring me with the party of Satan? Surely the party of Shaitan is weak. It is then that this man said, I decided that if she refuses to come out, I would bring plenty of firewood and burn everyone in this house until Ali is led to swear allegiance to the caliph. This man says, I took the whip of Munfad and I hit her with it. Then I said to Khalid ibn al-Walid, go you with your men and gather the firewood, for I shall set ablaze the house myself. Fatima responds, O enemy of Allah and His Messenger and the Commander of the Faithful. As Fatima cried out, I hit her once again on the head because she was holding the door and did not allow me to enter. He says that I tried to open the door but I still could not. Once again I hit the hands of Fatima with this whip and it hurt her. I could hear Fatima exhaling. I could hear Fatima crying. And I almost felt that my heart was becoming soft. But then I remembered the grudges of Ali and all of the blood he had spilled from the Arabs. So then I decided to let myself into the house. This time I did not whip. I decided to kick the door. Fatima was standing behind, supporting the door with her body. As I kicked the door open, I heard her let a scream so loud that turned Medina upside down. She cries, Ya Bata, O Messenger of Allah, should this be done to the one you love, to your daughter? O Fidda, take me. By Allah, what I have in my womb has been killed. Fidda says, I heard her birth pains and she supported herself with the wall. This wretched man said, I pushed the door and entered the house. I saw Fatima face me with a face that was caused my vision to be blurred. So then once again I slapped her on her face. I slapped her on her cheeks from outside the veil. Her earring was crushed into bits and pieces that scattered on the ground. It was only then that Ali came out. Day after day, Lady Fatima As a result of this violation and beating becomes weak. They say the women of Medina would come to see her and inquire, what illness do you have that when we see you day by day your condition worsens? Lady Fatima's body is so weak and feeble. On the final days and the final hours and moments, she calls her beloveds to come so she can share her final parting words. She speaks to Amir al-Mu'mineen and gives him a number of instructions. Ya Ali, ensure that you do the ghusl and washing of my body. Oh Ali, make sure you do the ghusl under a veil. Oh Ali, make sure you bury my body at night time. I don't want any of these wretched people to be in the procession. I don't want any of these wretched people to do salat over me. Oh Ali, I don't want the graveside to be known. I don't want any of these people to come across my grave. Amir al-Mu'mineen gathers the children. As Lady Fatima gives her final words, she breathes the final breaths and leaves this world. Ali prepares the body for washing. Under the veil, Ali is washing the body. As it is nighttime, he instructs all the children, keep your voices silent. We don't want to attract attention and inform others. But as Ali is washing the body of Fatima, she comes a point when Ali pauses. They see Ali has come now, puts his head to the wall and begins crying loudly. Oh Fatima, what has happened to your body? Oh Fatima, what are these bruises that I didn't know about? Oh Fatima, I thought we were going to be honest with one another. Oh Fatima, as Ali washed the body of Fatima and prepared her body for burial, before Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen wants to tie the kafan, he instructs the family to come one last time to bid their farewells from their mother. فَلَمَّا هَمَمْتُ أَنْ أَعْبِدَ الرِّدَى نَادَيْتُ يَا أُمَّ كُلْثُمْ يَا زَيْنَبْ يَا سُكَيْنَا يَا فِضَّةَ يَا حَسَنُ يَا حُسَيْنَ أَلُمُّ تَزَوَّدُوا مِنْ أُمِّكُمْ هذا الفراق واللقاء في الجنة. The Imam calls out all the children of Fidda, come and say your final farewells from your mother, for this is the final farewell. You will only be reunited in the paradise. فأقبل الحسن والحسين وهما يناديان وحسرة. Imam al-Hasan and Hussein console one another and cry out loud, وحسرة. لا تنتفل أبدا من فضل جدنا محمد المصطفى وأمنا فاطمة الزهراء. How will we ever continue with the loss of our grandfather, the Holy Prophet, and our mother, Lady Fatima? Ya Umm al-Hasan, Ya Umm al-Husayn, إذا بقيت جدنا محمد المصطفى فأقره منا السلام وقولي له إنا قد بقينا بعدك يتيمين. Bidar al-Dunya, oh our mother, oh son of Hassan, oh mother of Hassan, and oh mother of Hussein. When you see our grandfather, the Holy Prophet, send our salams and salutations and tell him, indeed we have been left in this world as orphans after you. فقال أمير المؤمنين إني أشهد الله أنها قد حنت وأنت ومدت يديها وذمتهما إلى صدرها مليا. It is at this time that the Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen says, by Allah, I am a witness that the hands of Fatima come and console the little bodies of Hassan and Hussein. She hugs them one last time. وَإِذَا بِهَاتِفٍ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ يُنَادِي يَا أَبَا الْحَسَنِ Then a call comes from the heavens saying, O father of Hassan, irfa'huma anha. Lift the body of these children from Zahra. فَلَغَدْ أَبْكِيَا وَاللَّهِ مَلَائِكَةَ السَّمَاوَاتِ. Indeed, the angels of the heavens are crying over witnessing the scene. فَلَدْ اشْتَاغَ الْحَبِيبُ إِلَى الْمَحْبُوبِ. Indeed, the beloved awaits their beloved. Before Amirul Mu'mineen takes the body of Fatima into her grave, she takes her body for one last farewell from the Holy Prophet. Amirul Mu'mineen states, O Prophet of God, peace and blessings be upon you and from your daughter, who has come to you and who has hastened to meet you. O Messenger, my patience about your daughter has been exhausted, and my power of endurance has weakened, except that I have ground for consolation in having endured the great hardship and heart-rending event of your separation. I laid you down in your grave while your last breath was between my neck and chest. And verily, we are from Allah, and indeed, due to Him we shall return. فَإِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. أَلَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم إنا نسألك ونعوذ باسمك العظيم العظيم العز الجل الأكرم. إلهي بحق الفاطمة يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك وفينا يا قاضي الحاجات ويا كاشف الهمات إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك على كل شيء قدير.